Animal lovers, get ready. Pet ghosts on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest, Joshua Warren. Joshua, pet ghost. Tell me about your Dachshund.
Yeah, she was a miniature Dachshund named Nellie. And after she died, I started hearing her whimpering and making little barking sounds around the house. And at first, I thought this has got to be my imagination because I was so used to hearing her. I figured that if there was some, you know, creak in the house or the refrigerator door squeaked or something like that, that I was just misinterpreting it because that's what my brain was expecting to hear. And then I also would hear what sounded like her little toenails scampering across the floor. But it wasn't until my fiance started hearing the same thing, and I didn't mention it to her because Nellie was her dog before we met, and I didn't want to bring it up. But she came to me and told me she was hearing the same thing. That's when I decided to do something that I rarely do. You see, I enjoy investigating haunted houses, but I don't want to live in one, so very seldom do I break out my equipment in my own house to see what's going on. But I did in this case. I took out my equipment, and sure enough, it didn't take very long for me to start documenting these energy fields, both electromagnetic and electrostatic in nature, that were perfectly suited to the dimensions of Nellie moving back and forth right along the pathways that she traveled most often in life. I was never able to get an image of her. It may be she was just too small and didn't have enough energy. I don't know. But I was so amazed by seeing how consistently her field was traveling back and forth that it sort of set me on a journey, you could say, exploring the history of these ghost animals and ghostly animals. And I was amazed by the fact that I've read every book that I can find on the subject. And before this book, Pet Ghosts, I have never seen a book that is comprehensive enough to give both personal experiences and the history and theories as to what may be happening here and practical tips on how you can investigate and observe these phenomena for yourself. And actually, the book's title may be a bit misleading because even though it's called Pet Ghosts, I mean, I explored everything from microorganisms all the way up to the fringes of creatures that we may or may not even classify as animals, like Bigfoot or Mothman or the Loch Ness Monster.
All right, we'll talk about that, too. Do you believe in reincarnation, Joshua?
I do believe that reincarnation makes sense. And, you know, I always, as many scientific researchers are, I'm always wary of the idea of belief because that implies that you accept something without evidence, but reincarnation does make sense to me, and I think there is some evidence for it.
The reason why I bring that up, is it possible that when a soul is reincarnated, that perhaps it can come back in an animal body? I mean, can your pet dog be, you know, have a soul of what was a human being the time before?
I think that that's perfectly plausible. I mean, you know, when you put humans and animals under a microscope, there is no blatant difference between the two of us. You know, I've been criticized in particular by some people of faith who say, well, how dare you imply that an animal could have a soul or a spirit like a human? Well, we are superior to them. Well, right off the bat, you don't necessarily have to have a soul or a spirit, however you define those terms, to produce a ghost. I mean, we have ghosts of ships and cars and stagecoaches as well as the horses pulling them. But beyond that, I mean, I don't see that we have any reason to believe, from what we can observe, there is some great difference physically and physiologically between humans and animals. And really, if you want to stretch it, there's not a huge amount of difference between us and plants. I mean, we're all mainly empty space and water, frankly. So I do think that there is some reason to think or believe that, you know, when we die, whatever this energy we have that is left over is recycled and can come back in any carbon-based life form.
I've got a lab puppy back home in St. Louis, and a smart little thing. And, you know, when you look at her, you just know that there's something beyond just, you know, an animal. There's just, there's intelligence, there's emotion, there's love in this animal. You can tell, you can feel it. It's there. And I've always wondered just what is their spirit like? What is that energy force that is part of the universe? And, you know, the more I talk with experts like you and put together some of my own thoughts and theories, yeah, I'm convinced it is possible that souls can reincarnate and come back, you know, in other life forms.
Well, at the very least, if we look at the law of conservation of energy, you know, stating that energy cannot be created nor destroyed, simply conserved and transferred into another form, I mean, at very least, even if a person is a complete, you know, has a complete atheistic Newtonian mindset and says, you know, there is no creation from some spiritual perspective, and that everything that dies is gone, and there is no memory or personality that retains itself, even those people surely must accept the fact that whatever energy that we did possess before we died goes back to the universe and is recycled in some form. And so from there, I mean, it's just a matter of how much meaning you apply to these recycled forms. But I agree entirely. And the more we observe animals, the more we see them acting like humans. Now, you always hate to personify animals too much because they are not like us directly in every way. But still, like you said, there is an essence there, which is something that sort of goes beyond words. It's just like I can't prove with a meter that I feel such a thing as love or hate. Or, you know, you can prove that there are certain electrical signals and things that you might be able to associate with those. But altogether, there are certain things we have to sense as one living creature to another that transcends what we can do with our technology. And I certainly think that there's no reason to believe that the energy we have cannot end up with another life form.
Why are they coming back, Joshua?
Well, you know, right off the bat, if you look at just the pet part, because, you know, again, the book goes into a much wider range, but let's look at pets specifically.
All right.
And I had to be careful in terms of how I defined a pet. You know, it's something we take for granted. But if you take the idea of an animal in general and you start exploring at what point does an animal become a pet, I basically came up with this specific definition. A pet is a specific animal that apparently shares a mutually beneficial relationship with a specific entity or entities, usually augmented by a higher degree of control by the involved entity or entities. And I use that word entity or entities because, frankly, if you look back, say, through a text like the Bible, you could make a case for, say, the snake in Genesis being the pet of God, the pet of Satan, and the snake in Exodus being a pet of God, you know. So nonetheless, if you take the idea of a pet having some mutually beneficial relationship with an owner, shall we say, look how much we allow our pets to depend on us in life. We take care of all their primary needs, you know, food, water, health care, shelter. And then when they die, if there is some awareness there, well, they are completely lost in this spiritual form. They don't know what's happened. They don't know what's going on. Where are they going to go for an answer? They're going to come back to us, the owners. But at that point, however, if we are not receptive to the fact that they are there, well, then it's going to shock them even more because suddenly they're going to realize that we don't know that they exist. And this usually goes on for a week, 2 weeks, maybe at the most a month, at the most, even though there are exceptions. And then the pet loses interest and realizes, I'm not getting anywhere with this owner anymore, and they move on.
They move on, and they move on pretty quickly then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they usually do. Now, the exceptions are cases that, you know, where the animal can be around for years and years, but usually that's when the owner is somehow, shall we say, enticing the animal, a person who wants the animal to be around. And if you want your pet, Gus, to stick around, I mean, you keep putting out the food, keep bringing out the favorite toys, keep talking to it, treating it like it's there, and it'll stick around for about as long as you want it to be there. But otherwise, if you ignore it and move on with your life after the grieving process, as most of us do, well, then generally the activity stops after a few weeks.
You've interviewed some people that we know and respect, Brad Steiger, Nick Redfern, the cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman. What do they all say about this situation?
Well, Nick Redfern had his own personal experience with a pet ghost. He had a Shar Pei that was particularly loved by his wife. And after the dog passed away, they were moving out of the house. And his wife was concerned about leaving the dog ghost behind because, I mean, they had heard the dog. They'd seen the dog's impact around the food bowl and the impression on the carpet. I mean, they knew this ghost was sticking around. His wife was concerned that the dog might not come with them. And when they moved everything out of the house, they thought, I mean, everything was gone. And his wife insisted that he go back in and just double check. And so Nick went in and he reached a cupboard that had a shelf that was a little taller than him, and he was feeling around up there, and he felt his fingers hit something plastic, and he pulled down a photograph of their dog, the Shar Pei. Charity was her name, and it was just almost a chilling moment for him because it was like the dog was symbolizing the fact that she wanted every trace of her to go along with them, and that was a comforting thought for them. So Nick, he definitely thinks there's something to it. Now, Brad Steiger, goodness, he has had numerous experiences with not only pet ghosts, but what I call phantomals. You see, when I was doing the research for this book...
Phantomals, you call them.
Yeah, that's a term that I had to coin because ghosts are generally divided into two categories. You have entities, which seem to be interactive and aware and cognizant and conscious, and you have imprints, which are redundant, and they seem almost like a signature on an audio or video tape that replays itself over and over when the conditions are right. But then you also have ghostly animals, like the hellhounds of Europe, that sort of appear out of nowhere and raise havoc and then disappear. And they look basically like regular dogs, but they are extremely different in the fact they have these huge hulking forms. They have a glow around them. They burn people and objects that are near them. And you say, where did this thing come from? You know, or you have something like, you know, a Mothman type figure. Well, that's a ghostly animal. Even, you know, I mentioned the snakes in the Bible. We know that the Bible starts out with a talking snake. Now, whether or not we believe the Bible is true or not, the people who wrote the Bible, we can assume, believe that there was some truth to that. And we know that snakes don't usually talk. So, I mean, what is this creature, this talking snake? How does it fit into this whole definition? And then you've got harbingers, which are these creatures that seem to carry a message or are charged with a particular purpose, like a witch's familiar, let's say a black cat or a wizard's owl. And so in order to conveniently talk about all these things, I came up with this term phantomals as just a general term to account for any paranormal creature that appears more animal-like than human-like.
You know, in the movie The Omen, the original one, what that dog was, that a Rottweiler or was it a Doberman? I'm not sure. I think it was a Rottweiler.
Yeah, I believe you're right.
Why do they, even in movies, why do they make animals like that seem possessed? I mean, is that real? Do they do things like that? Are things like that occurring?
Well, that's what the record tells us. Yes, that you know, those are traditional archetypes of these creatures. I mean, they often are reported as looking like Rottweilers, even though they're much larger. And they always seem to have some kind of purpose when they appear. It's just like, you know, going back to the traditional hellhounds, you know, we have reports of them as early as, I think, the 800s or something like that in France. But it really started becoming prevalent in England There was an incident in 1587 that occurred at a church in Bungay, and in the middle of a service in August, while, by the way, there was a raging thunderstorm outside, so there's our electrical component, at least one dog just appeared out of nowhere, came charging into the church, killed several people, tearing limbs off, burning stuff. It was so heavy, there was so much density, that some portions of the masonry collapsed and killed other people, and then it just vanished. It apparently looked sort of like, you know, a big Rottweiler. About 10 miles down the road, another one popped up at another church service and did essentially the same thing. In fact, to this day, the incident made such an impact that you can find a black dog on the official crest of Bungay. So when you look at these reports, and of course there's no way for us to go back and verify if this really happened hundreds of years ago, but there are so many reports of this type of thing happening, and they describe the dog so consistently as looking like a Rottweiler, or in other cases maybe somewhat like a Labrador, that's where the image comes from. It's based on the historical record.
You know, so many people would love to contact their departed animal. They love them. They become family. They're like children. You offer some tips. Can you just give us some highlights?
Sure. Well, if you want to contact the pet, well, the first thing is, indeed, as I mentioned earlier, to try to create an environment that suggests the pet is not dead. You know, bring out the pet's favorite toys or food and conduct yourself in a manner just as if the pet were alive. Aside from that, you want to try to, of course, document right off the bat whether or not the pet really is around. Two simple tools you can use for that. If you want to go out and buy an electronic piece of equipment like a paranormal investigator uses, that's wonderful. But if not, the next best thing for the average layperson is just to get a compass, walk around that area where you think the pet ghost may be, and if the compass deviates from north, well, then you've encountered a magnetic or electromagnetic anomaly, which seems to suggest there could be an apparition there. In fact, if you lay down a compass or two or three compasses, and along that pathway, you will see them deviate if the pet spirit walks through there. Secondly, take a fluorescent light bulb, hold it in your hand, and walk around the area. If you don't want any wires hooked to this, if you enter an area with high electrostatic charges, that light bulb will start flickering in your hand. These are all ways to tell that you may have a pet spirit around. Once you feel confident with that, the next thing you want to do is wait until about somewhere between 11 p.m. and 4 a.m. in the morning, because that's when the Earth's magnetosphere is nice and calm, and these subtle energy fields can manifest most easily. Sit down, turn off the TV, turn off any overpowering electronic or electromagnetic device, turn down the lights so that you can see some of these sort of dim illuminations with your naked eyes, and sit back and wait for the pet ghost to appear. If it doesn't happen after about an hour, break out a strobe light. Turn on the strobe light. That will help you also see them if they are oscillating at a rate too fast for your eyes to usually perceive.
But you'll see them briefly during the oscillation, right?
Yeah, you'll see them for at least a few seconds between two or three different flashes.
The fact that you can do this electronically, that you need equipment, tells you what about what they are?
Well, it shows us that the conditions for them to appear as fully as we would hope, you know, where you can see them, hear them, appreciate them in all their dimensions, and this is based upon the interviews that I've done, then those conditions are rare. I mean, you can also enhance the overall conditions by turning down the humidity. I mean, if you have a dehumidifier, run it, because the electrostatic charges can build up much more powerfully when the humidity is low.
Interesting. Yeah.
And it shows us
science.
In other cases, you've got to rely upon the tools because the conditions are not right.
Stay with us, Joshua. We'll be right back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Do you have a good animal ghost story? Well, we're going to take your calls next hour, and I'll be back in a moment with Joshua Warren on Coast to Coast AM. Joshua, absolutely incredible work that you've done. Where is the book available, Pet Ghosts? How do they get it?
Well, I appreciate that, George. Pet Ghost Animal Encounters from Beyond the Grave should be available at very least by order through all major bookstores. Or if you go to my personal website, joshuapwarren.com, last name is spelled W-A-R-R-E-N, you will find a section with books as well as news that will give you a link to Amazon.com and everyone else at joshuapwarren.com. And that is, of course, linked up through coasttocoastam.com on my name.
Now, those in the greater Los Angeles area that want to see you at Ghost Fest on the Queen Mary, will you have books there?
You know, I personally do not have any books. I'm hoping my publisher will help me out with that. But in that case, you might want to go. I know in Anaheim, you can go to the Learning Light Center. They have some books. I did a little program there earlier this evening. But hopefully you can maybe at least find them at a local bookstore and bring them to the Ghost Fest. And, you know, again, I'll be there tomorrow, Saturday, and Sunday, and I'll be available for book signings the whole time. And also, I'm so amazed by how little research has been done in this field. I want to find more stories, because think about how often a person you know dies. Hopefully, it's not that often. But pets die, you know, all the time. They don't have the same lifespan that we do. They're subject to other problems, like being hit by cars and so on. And I think that this is a valuable resource for us, since that pets are, or animals in general, are so much like us physically. We need to start looking more carefully at this database. And so anybody who wants to come see me and share an experience with me will be valued.
Let's talk about Bigfoot, Mothman, and some other of these creatures, physical or semi-physical. Why do you include them in this book?
Well, right off the bat, I suppose, there are some people who say that someone like, well, something like Mothman should be called Big Hoot. In fact, Mark A. Hall is a researcher who said Mothman should be called Big Hoot because Mothman was a big owl. And we have this idea of Mothman as being, you know, a man who has wings and big red eyes. And in fact, if you go to Point Pleasant, West Virginia, you'll see a statue of just that sitting in the middle of the town there. However, witnesses describe Mothman as looking much different, as having a very small head, as having wings sort of humped up on either side of the head, higher than the head area, and altogether may have looked like a huge owl. The problem, however, is that many people reported this this creature doing things that a big owl cannot do, such as flying at length without flapping its wings, almost like it's just hovering, or giving people radiation burns around their faces when they look directly at it. And of course, we don't know for sure if these quote-unquote glowing eyes were actually glowing or just reflecting light like a cat's. But whatever the case, we can say that Mothman may have been one of two things. If we rule out it was just a big owl because of the things I mentioned, well, then it could be the ghost of a big owl that once lived, similar to a thunderbird. Or Mothman could have been a creature altogether different that was semi-physical, that came from another dimension, if you will, because as I said earlier, we have no reason scientifically to think that life cannot exist in realms that are non-physical to us. And so there may have been some changes going on in that environment at the time. You know, if you look at the Earth in general, they have these really fantastic maps of the Earth showing in graphic detail the gravity field around the planet, and it's inconsistent and lumpy. and yet we know that gravity warps a lot of things, including time. I mean, a clock in your attic runs faster than a clock in your basement,
right,
because of the gravitational field. And we know that the Earth's gravitational field is affected by a lot of things, even including some of the solar storms, just like the magnetosphere. And so it may be that sometimes there's some warping that goes on at certain places, such as perhaps Point Pleasant, West Virginia, and that allows us to distort that boundary between our realm and these other realms. And for a limited period of time, we are able to temporarily experience these creatures that exist in a realm just outside our own. And therefore, I think there's good reason to believe that Mothman may have been one of those creatures, because after the Silver Bridge collapsed, this devastating event in which over 40 people died, mm-hmm. the Mothman sightings kind of dropped off.
Right.
So it leads you to believe that there was something building up that discharged. And so I think a creature like Mothman, it applies to this concept of phantomals in the sense of what we might think of as an elemental, which is a creature like the hellhounds that is definitely more animal-like than human-like. But it exists in some realm beyond our own, and it sort of slips in and out. Bigfoot may be exactly the same way, because we have all these reports of people seeing Bigfoot, and he either vanishes altogether, or they're following a trail of his tracks, and they just stop in the middle of nowhere, like he was suddenly, you know, beamed up into a spaceship or something. And the weird thing is that when these creatures are here, they seem to be fully interactive with our physical realm. I mean, Bigfoot leaves hairs and footprints, and I don't think all these people are lying or crazy or whatever when they say they've seen this ape-like 8-foot-tall creature. But the fact of the matter is, if this 8-foot-tall, 750-pound creature covered in hair is running around all 50 states every year, and we do get reports from all 50 states every year, there should be more hair, there should be more footprints, there should be more evidence, more of an impact on the ecology if he's there all the time. And therefore, I think that he's one of these phantomals that's slipping back and forth. And it's a very unpopular idea with a lot of cryptozoologists who consider that blasphemy. A
couple of interesting reports recently in Wisconsin of Bigfoot sightings, though one of the eyewitnesses claims that it could have been an animal. He wasn't quite sure. But nonetheless, these reports, Joshua, continue to come in.
Yeah, they sure do. They roll in every year, and sometimes we get these reports from creatures that we can't even really classify in any direct way. There are so many people writing me and telling me about animals that look like 4-foot-tall foxes walking upright with huge eyes and long, bushy tails. The idea of something like an ape is popular. I think it took a while for something like the chupacabra to catch on. And you've got all these weird creatures. And even if you look at the orb phenomenon, have you ever noticed how much some of these orbs look like cells?
Yes.
Just big biological cells.
Blobby cells.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing I wrote about in Pet Ghost, I look at microorganisms all the way up to some of these bigger creatures. You know, in 2003, there was a Romanian physicist who made what I considered a startling sort of announcement. They replicated some of the conditions that most scientists believe existed on our planet during its infancy, and they created these, as they call them, blobs of plasma that seemed to be alive. They had a little chamber, and they filled it with argon and then introduced some arcs of electricity, sort of like lightning storms. And these cell-like spheres of plasma were just spontaneously created in less than a second. And they could grow, they could replicate by dividing. They said they could even communicate, that they were sort of emanating electromagnetic energy back and forth from one to another. And in fact, a quote here I'm looking at in my book, the scientist said, "The emergence of such spheres seems likely to be a prerequisite for biochemical evolution," end quote. Now, if in fact that's correct, and we're looking at the idea that some basic life forms are nothing more than big cells that have these electromagnetic properties, it makes me wonder if some of these orb-like anomalies are creatures no different that are usually in a realm outside of our own, and yet in that thinning process of the veil, so to speak, between our realm and theirs, sometimes we are able to see them materialize. And in fact, you know, there is a link at coasttocoastam.com to a piece of video.
Yeah, footage. Explain this. I want everyone to go to the coasttocoastam.com website, look at the feature article. It's a piece of video that Joshua has sent us. Those of you who are on your computers right now, you're going to get there really fast. Those of you who aren't, we'll give you just a few seconds to get there. Set it up for us first, Joshua, before they play this video.
Well, Brian Irish is our chief investigator. He's our imaging specialist. He's worked with me for years. And there was a time when we started getting really frustrated with the whole orb phenomenon because there's so many things that can create orbs, as we all know, like dust and insects and moisture. And people were always, you know, getting overly excited and sending us pictures of orbs. But the fact of the matter is, even though we got to a point where we said, look, just don't send us orbs anymore, it just wouldn't go away. I mean, there were so many people who were saying, look, I'm getting orbs here that I cannot explain after ruling out everything. And we even ourselves got some of those orbs. And so we have been looking at some of the better orb footage out there and trying to determine what relationship it may have to other fields of energy in the environment. Well, Brian Irish was at a haunted house recently rolling his camera, and he captured an orb-like anomaly that shoots out of a television set when the television is not turned on. Now, a television is a very powerful electrostatic machine. I mean, I often use it as an example. I tell people, if you want to know what an electrostatic field feels like, turn on your television and put your knuckles up to the screen, and you're going to feel that tingly, thick sensation. That's an electrostatic field. Well, when the TV is off, there's still a capacitor in the back that's charged with a lot of electrostatic potential. You may have gotten the warnings in the past, you know, don't work on a television if you don't know what you're doing, because you know, you'll kill yourself when the capacitor zaps you. And so to see an orb emerge from a television is quite telling. No pun intended. And I think that after we saw that happen, we said, okay, we need to conduct an experiment that looks even more carefully at what this orb phenomenon is all about. And as you mentioned, the footage I just described is freely available at coasttocoastam.com. You can see this orb shoot out of the television set. Now, here's the experimentation that we've developed based upon that. One of the theories behind orbs is that even when you have an orb appearing that is the product of, if you have an orb that's the product of something conventional, dust or moisture, generally you have a cluster of them. I mean, you don't often go into a place that's dusty and have just one speck of dust. You don't go outside when it's moist and have just one droplet of moisture, you know. So if you get clusters of things, you can rule those out pretty easily. But when you get one that behaves in a strange fashion, well, think about this. If you take a comb and you rub it through your hair, you can pick up little bits and pieces of paper with it. There's an electrostatic attraction there. Now, we know that there are these electrostatic fields that are passing through areas that are supposed to be haunted. We don't know exactly what the source of these fields is, but you can imagine when this field is moving through an area, what's it going to do? It's going to attract every little particle, every bit of airborne debris in the area to the source of that field and create a little clump of material that's sort of like a flying dust footprint, you could say, that's sort of moving around there. And when you photograph it with a flash, the flash bounces off the clump, and because of the way the aperture is designed, it creates a circle or a sphere of light right at that point. If you have video footage, you can see how it moves. Now, that all may sound great, theoretically, saying that an electrostatic field will attract particles and you get an orb, and therefore the electrostatic field orb is still a paranormal phenomenon, but where's the evidence? Well, we decided to test this and see if we could prove a correlation between electrostatic fields and orbs. And we have a piece of footage that, if all goes well, I'm going to play. and that is not haunted, to the best of our knowledge, and we set it up just as if we were investigating that room as a haunted location. We had the video cameras rolling, mm-hmm. we had the still camera set up, but in the middle was a Van de Graaff generator that was producing 150,000 volts of electrostatic energy.
Oh my! Now, what if you touch that? Would you get zapped big time?
Not really. No, it's very low very low amperage.
Okay.
In fact, I touch them all the time, and it's, you know, you just get a little.
These are the kind I've seen, like at magic houses, where your hair stands right up when you touch the ball.
That's exactly
right. Okay.
Yeah, it's a big silver ball, and this was even a little one. So this was, you know, a very small amount of energy compared to what you'd get at some of these types of places you're talking about. And so we turned out the lights. We turned on the infrared illuminators, just like we were at a haunted place. At that point, I hit the Van de Graaff's button, and immediately an orb shot out of the Van de Graaff. Now, there was no ghost there, to my knowledge. Instead, we created a powerful electrostatic field, and I mean, without hesitation, we got an orb.
Do you think an orb is under intelligent design, that it thinks, it moves, it maneuvers, it knows what it's doing?
Well, it could be. You see, that's the point of the experiment. We have proven, at least, that if there is an electrostatic field, and we're in the early stages, we're going to repeat this many times before we say that we've conclusively proven. But I should rephrase it and say, at this point, it appears that we are in the process of proving that an electrostatic field can create an orb. Now, the issue of whether or not the orb is showing us an electrostatic field that is artificial or one that is the product of an intelligent control depends on next how we interpret the movement of the orb. Now, we can tell with our testing that when you produce the field, the orb is going to pretty much go in one direction or another. I mean, it's going to go away from or toward the source of energy, black or white.
Right.
On the other hand, if you get an orb that is not doing that, and we have many of them that are pausing in midair, that are sitting there for a few seconds and then turning around and going in an opposite direction, or are going in all other types of patterns that we cannot account for, at that point, that's when we start to say, all right, it looks like we may have something of a truly paranormal nature, especially since we even ourselves have footage of orbs that go into objects, something like, Brian Irish has footage of a dresser. An orb goes into one side of the dresser, and then it emerges
it
from the other
side. Yeah, see, that's incredible. You know, we get a lot of pictures, Joshua, that I pass on to Lex, of people that claim they've taken pictures of orbs, but a lot of them are, you know, light refraction or raindrops and things like that. But what I'm seeing recently in a lot of your video and pictures, I mean, these things are weird. I mean, to go in and out of, that's not a raindrop. That's not refraction.
No, and I mean, like you, we view thousands of these things every year, and the overwhelming majority of them can be explained conventionally, but it's that minority that really makes you scratch your head. And I think that some of the research that we're doing right now is proving, or in the process of proving, that there is some objective component aside from an optical illusion to some of these orbs, and we want to get to the point where we can say, would you like to see an orb, Mr. Norrie? You know, tell us what kind of characteristics you want it to have.
And here it comes.
Yeah, and we produce that for you in a laboratory, and to show you we understand exactly what's happening when we get this footage, except in the footage we get, there is no Van de Graaff generator sitting there, so where the heck is the energy coming from?
Joshua, stay with us for the final hour. We're going to take phone calls. Those of you with incredible pet ghost stories, share them, or other questions for our guest, Joshua Warren. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.